You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm Amy Yankin, the director of the Open Society Institute's Documentary Photography Project. I want to welcome you here to this evening's panel discussion, co-sponsored by my project and OSI's National Security and Human Rights Campaign. When we started planning this event in early spring, we did not know how timely the issue would become. With the release of the ICRC report in April and the possibility of further images from Abu Ghraib and other sites becoming public, there has been a call for accountability. I'm therefore very excited about tonight's discussion. Before I turn things over to our panelists, I do want to say a few words about photography. Photography, after all, is what opened the window into the acts of torture and abuse taking place at Abu Ghraib. When those shocking images appeared 5 years ago, Americans were forced to visually confront atrocities occurring in Iraq. The images personalized the war and brought the conflict closer to home. They served to hold accountable those responsible for the abuse. At the same time, though, they further victimized the subjects of that abuse. Chris Bartlett, one of tonight's panelists, took formal portraits of these individuals to show them as dignified individuals and not merely victims. If you have not done so already, I urge you to view Chris's deeply moving portraits, which are part of the Moving Walls exhibition just outside this door. OSI has a deep commitment to documentary photography, in particular, the documenting of human rights and social justice issues. We see photography as a visual advocacy tool, and among other efforts, created the Moving Walls exhibition as one mechanism to illustrate issues of importance to OSI that often do not find exposure in mainstream media. I now want to introduce our moderator, Stephen Rickard. Steve is the director of the Washington Office of the Open Society Institute. Under his direction, the office engages in advocacy on U.S. and international issues, including promotion of human rights and support for open societies abroad. Rickard has a distinguished career as a Washington advocate for human rights. Before joining OSI, Steve served as the director of the Nuremberg Legacy Project, working to promote U.S. support for international justice. Steve was also the director of the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Center for Human Rights and the Washington Director for Amnesty International USA. And I just want to say on a personal note that Steve has been a huge supporter of the Moving Walls exhibition and deeply committed to it when it travels to his office in Washington. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks so much, Amy. It is a real privilege and honor to be here tonight. There are many, many wonderful things that go along with being a part of OSI and having my job. One of the real perks of being a part of OSI is that the Washington office participates in the Moving Walls program, and we've been privileged to host extraordinary exhibitions of art and documentary photography in Washington. We're extremely pleased that we will host these photographs eventually in the Washington office and are looking forward to doing that. One of the other benefits of being a part of OSI is that you have such extraordinary colleagues, and it's really, I'm very pleased to be able to be with a number of my colleagues tonight. At the risk of singling out a limited segment and not wanting to offend anyone that I don't specifically mention, I do want to particularly thank and mention our colleagues in U.S. programs who work so hard on these issues and have been such an important part of the effort to push back on the abuses of the Bush administration over the last few years. And they're here tonight. Ann Beeson is the director of U.S. programs. Nancy Chang is the head of the National Security and Human Rights Program. And Sophia Conroy is here somewhere. Is here? There we go, Sophia. So I want to thank my colleagues in the National Security Program. It really is a privilege for me to be able to moderate the panel tonight. We really have an extraordinary group of individuals here. And we have people here who can really speak in a powerful and knowledgeable way about what happened, about what impact what happened had on the individuals, about why we can't ever forget the humanity of the people who were victimized, and why what was done needs to be addressed, that there needs to be compensation, and we cannot simply turn the page on this. And my own view is that Chris Bartlett's photographs do something very important. It was common for the Bush administration to defend against its critics by ridiculing the notion that what was happening was particularly severe because it wasn't on the scale of what happened under Saddam or what happens in North Korea. And I think Chris's photographs are the ultimate refutation of that argument, because what they remind us in the most powerful and effective way possible is that when you have victimization and atrocity and torture, there is no scale. There is a person who is a victim, and we can't ever lose sight of that. It's not about numbers, it's about people and human beings, and these photographs are an extraordinary testament to that fact. And all of our panelists can address that issue and bring that in sharp focus to it. And I just want to, I won't recite their bios, which you have, but I do want to briefly introduce them, and then we'll go down the list. Very pleased to have Susan Burke with us. Susan's a founding member of the firm of Burke O'Neill, which is, it says here, a boutique litigation. I'm going to say a specialist in complex litigation with a list of offices which must be, maybe unprecedented. There are offices in Philadelphia, Chicago, Charlottesville, and Baghdad. So, but most importantly, Susan is the lead counsel on the class action brought on behalf of the torture victims at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in Iraq. And we're really delighted to have you here, and we're looking forward to hearing from you. Next, we'll hear from Alan Keller. It's been my real privilege to get to know Alan over the last few years and to work with him on various advocacy efforts in Washington. Alan is the director of the NYU School of Medicine Center for Health and Human Rights, the director of the Bellevue NYU program for survivors of torture. Alan has won many awards for his extraordinary work, has provided through his center services to 2,500 men, women, and children from 80 countries. And we're pleased to note that he was one of the original Soros Advocacy Fellows. We will then hear from Chris. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about what motivated Chris to undertake this project, what he learned, what he has to share from that project. He is one of the leading freelance still life photographers in the United States. His work has appeared in Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, Town and Country, and other publications. Finally, we will hear from Matthew Alexander. Many of you perhaps have had an opportunity to read and hear Matthew over the last year or two. He has really become one of the clarion voices pushing back against the notion that what was done in Abu Ghraib, in Guantanamo, in Bagram, what is what claimed to be necessity for our defense, not only was contrary to our values, but was not necessary. He is the author of the book How to Break a Terrorist, The U.S. Interrogators Who Use Brains, Not Brutality to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. And we are very pleased to be able to announce that he will shortly be an Open Society Fellow, and we're looking forward to being able to contribute to his very important work. And so with that, let me turn it over to Susan. Each of our panelists will make some brief introductory remarks. I think you can speak from a seated position, and then we'll begin with a few. I'll ask a few introductory questions, and then we'll open it up.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming. One of the things I like to share at the beginning whenever I speak before a group is how much it means to the victims that there are Americans who are interested in their plight. I began this work in 2003, and I've traveled repeatedly to the Mideast to interview victims. I've probably personally interviewed about 75 so far. We have many, many still to go. And along with my co-counsel, Katie Gallagher, from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's right back there, we have brought a series of lawsuits. We originally filed a lawsuit in June 2004 as a class action, and we sued the two American corporations, CACI, C-A-C-I, and a company that was then called Titan, is now owned by L3. we sued those two companies alleging a conspiracy to torture. And the conspiracy included military, and we had to file a RICO statement naming the co-conspirators, and they included the likes of Rumsfeld and others, names that you all know. But our legal challenge was to make it, you know, simple. I mean, this is not, in a sense, it's not a complicated issue. Torture is illegal, has always been illegal. The laws are straightforward. The laws are clear. The fact that, you know, folks generated a bunch of memos to try to muddy the water shouldn't really matter. So we have always stuck to the basics. This was a criminal conspiracy. And what's so important as more and more comes out, and as you see, for example, the Senate Armed Services Committee report, and you meet people like Matthew Alexander, what is very clear throughout this is that not everybody participated in this conspiracy. There were many interrogators who chose not to, and we believe that the ones who chose to participate need to be punished. Our power to punish and hold them accountable is fairly limited. We're, you know, essentially a private law firm. But what we try to do is go after essentially the weaker link in the conspiracy, the corporate actors who hopefully do not have the same sovereign immunity protecting them from accountability that Rumsfeld and some of the others have. So we filed suit and have brought it forward in the district court in D.C. We ended up, after some very preliminary discovery on immunity issues, we ended up prevailing against CACI and losing against L3. The court held that CACI could be forced to stand trial for the torture because their corporate employees were under their control. So headquarters back in Arlington, Virginia, could have stopped them from opting into the torture conspiracy. The judge found, over our strenuous objections, that L3, Titan, was not similarly situated, that they had essentially just given their employees to the military, and therefore they were cloaked in the same sovereign garb as the soldiers. Both sides appealed, and it is now, it has been argued, we had an argument in the D.C. Circuit, and that's pending a decision. Our panel in D.C. was made up of Silberman, Kavanaugh, and Garland. So for those of you who are court watchers, you may be able to predict we may lose that one, given the composition. We hope we won't, but we may. So we did not want to let the matter rest, and we continued through our office in Baghdad, we continued to get more and more victims coming to us. Often people are not willing and ready to talk about being tortured for a few years. So what we found is over time, the ranks of the victims continue to grow. So we've started more suits, and we're going to continue to file more suits until hopefully, you know, we at the very, you know, least, we're hoping to get a circuit split that forces it up to the Supreme Court. So through our, we have a wonderful office manager, our employee in Baghdad, Dr. Majid, is just a dear human being. And so through this, we have met just some phenomenal people. The forgiving nature and the bravery of the victims that voluntarily come to a set of American lawyers, I mean, you know, I just find that staggering. I don't think if I were tortured by somebody, I would, you know, turn around and still seek justice in their system. So I find it something of hope for all of us that there's still enough faith in the American system that they're looking to us to help them. And I've been very pleased to be able to work with Dr. Keller as our expert witness, who has come over and examined the victims. And then we had the great pleasure to bring Chris Bartlett with us, and whose beautiful work touches everyone's heart that see it. So very much appreciate everyone being here. And as always, I kind of email back to Dr. Majid saying, you know, the Americans do care. You know, there were about 100 people there today. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Susan. And when we talked about this meeting, I promised I would be strict about the time limit so that we could have lots of conversation, but I don't have to. You were, that was remarkable. Very
you
good.
Said 5 minutes.
You
said
you set the standard, so Alan would.
I may just stand.
Okay, well, then.
Do I need to?
Well, you can stand. You just need
I
to take my mic.
Thank you. Does that count as they say in the debates, as 15 seconds? In any case, thank you so much for the privilege of being here. I am just so grateful to the Open Society Institute. It is that rare phenomena when an organization truly lives up to its name of open society, and that so much of who I am as a physician, as a scientist, as a human being, was shaped by this wonderful organization that allowed me to make the transition from really a full-time clinician doing human rights work to more of a scientist and advocate and free up that time. And the individuals from Steve and from all of my project officers that I've worked with are epitomized professionalism, humanism, and an open society. My colleague Susan Burke, who in addition to having taught me so much about working and interviewing these individuals, but also is one heck of a travel agent, and my colleagues, fellow panelists, who I'm humbled by. So what I want to just talk about very briefly is, a few things. First of all, words, as we know, have meaning. Photographs have meaning. Actions and accountability have meaning, and that's what we're here for. And I want to talk about these from sort of three crucial components of medicine and being a physician: the clinical aspect, the scientific aspect, and then that part that often doesn't get revealed, the humanistic aspect. So first, the clinical. As Susan mentioned, I was part of a team. We conducted interviews with 12 former detainees from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. We did this on behalf of Physicians for Human Rights. Each interview evaluation we did was done with a physician and a mental health professional. Actually, in all the cases, it was an internist and a psychologist. And each evaluation, we spent 1 to 2 days full time on. Now, we took breaks. There was time lost. But there was a lot done. It included a detailed history, review of symptoms, a psychological evaluation, and then a physical examination, and then some other tests if we could do it. And what we found was, quite devastating. Now, when I'm in the room wearing my forensic hat, I always presume anything I write, anything I say, I need to be able to justify in open court why I said it. So I actually don't use the word torture lightly. And in fact, I err, if anything, on the side of not invoking that term. But what I heard from these individuals, by any stretch, could only be called that. These were individuals who were deprived of sleep, not for days, not for weeks, but sometimes months at end. These were individuals who were forced to stand naked in the cold, not for 1 minute, not for 2 minutes, not for an hour, but several hours, repeatedly beaten, subjected to humiliation, subjected to fear of being attacked by dogs, and on and on and on it goes. And a common thread in all of these is the complete loss of control. That Mr. Rumsfeld and others may say, well, I'm on my feet for 12 hours a day, or our former mayor saying, gee, I'm up all night. You're saying sleep deprivation is torture? Well, control is a central thing. And for all of these individuals, control was utterly stamped upon and decimated. So the clinical findings were highly consistent with what the individuals reported, what we found on the physical and psychological evaluations. You sit in a room with somebody for 2 days, maybe you can get the wool pulled over your eye, but you get a sense of who that individual is. And the consistency, the integrity with which, and candor about what they did remember, what they didn't remember, what they were and were not willing to talk about, was striking, and left me with unequivocally being able to say, in my professional estimation and willingness to stake my professional reputation on it, because basically that's what you're doing. At the end of the day, all I have in that work is credibility, that these individuals clearly were tortured. So scientific, that term scientific infers, well, from what we see, what can we infer from about a larger population? The notion, and maybe we'll come back to this later, that this was an isolated phenomena, a group of bad apples, so on and so forth, doesn't do what my wife Susie often referred to in her closing arguments as an assistant district attorney of, it just doesn't make sense. There's too much contradicting, too much of a pattern of what we know happened in Afghanistan, what we know or have quite strong reason to believe happened in Guantanamo and in secret prisons, so on and so forth. So the notion of bad apple doesn't make sense. Epidemiologically, what does this mean? We really don't know. We were actually talking about this on a call in preparation for this. Are we talking about 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 individuals? We don't know, but we really can approximate that it's much more than just a few thousand. And that's on the basis of that these individuals, those individuals in the photographs, every one of them was ultimately released without ever having been charged. And they were caught up in sweeps, and that happened over and over again. So I'm sure my colleagues will be able to talk more upon this, but an isolated phenomena, a bad apple phenomena, morally, clinically, scientifically, doesn't add up. Now, the last thing I'll talk about very briefly is the humanistic perspective. So I go in there very seriously, very focused as a clinician, as a scientist, as an expert witness. I am not there in a doctor-patient classic relationship, although despite what some of our colleagues in psychology and psychiatry have said that, well, when you're doing one thing, it's one set of moral principles, it's another, it's not. No, it's just that I was not there to be providing ongoing care to these individuals. And that's the first humanistic thing. It was one of the more painful experiences that, you know, when I see a torture survivor at Bellevue and NYU with my colleagues who are just some of the most dedicated clinicians I know, that we've treated enough individuals that I know what's at the end and that it's not sugar-coated, but there's a lot that we can do to help people. For these individuals, it was terribly painful, although any pain I had, you know, is minuscule compared to what they had, of the sense of that, okay, when I said goodbye, they were leaving, and I had no idea. There was one individual, or one or two individuals I was able to refer for a treatment where we were, but the others were literally falling back into an abyss from hell. And that was terribly painful. The other thing was, when the suffering, it was clear and consistent with all of these individuals that these were caring, decent men who were shells of who they were from a clinical or a humanistic perspective, that their heart, their souls, their psychic well-being had just been torn out from them. That was, and when you stepped back and thought about the pain and the suffering that I had with my clinical and scientific hat on documented, it was so horrible. And it can, I guess, be epitomized in one moment at the hotel. And I don't think this will compromise my expert witness status, because I will say that I unequivocally drew my clinical impressions before the event that I think this is probably the first time I'm saying this in public, occurred, which was when at this hotel where we were staying, we said our goodbyes to the detainees. And it was quite, as you can imagine, awkward being an American physician. And by the way, it's a whole other thing, but American health professionals, including physicians, clearly were complicit in their abuse. When I said goodbye, you know, I went and reached out my hand to one of the individuals. It wasn't one in those photographs, which I think, you know, reveal the heart and soul of who these individuals are and the sadness and the strength. So I reached out my hand to him to say goodbye, and he pulled me in and he whispered in my ear and he said, "Thank you." I was like, "Thank you for what?" And when we'd first met after, like, we took our first break, he kind of said to me, "Gee, you know, you're not such a bad American." And I was like, "Well, gee, I guess everything's relative. As long as I'm not, you know, abusing him and, you know, or whatever, that makes me better." But so this time he pulled me and he said, "Thank you." And I said, "For what?" He said, "Well, thank you for reminding me that there are good Americans, there are bad Americans, there are good Iraqis, there are bad Iraqis, there are good people, and there are bad people." And he pulled me in and he gave me a hug. And I had to excuse myself, and I just went in another room, and I just started sobbing because I felt just that profound sense of sadness. And, you know, quickly kind of pulled myself back together and, you know, went and, you know, wished him well, went to try and do the best I could to say, okay, I would suggest you get this and done. And I wrote the names of some medications that I said, if you could get access to these, it would be helpful. So the pain and suffering is profound. The need for accountability is profound. The need for a commitment to healing these individuals whose resilience is demonstrated and dignity is demonstrated in this set of photographs, which was so ruthlessly stripped, as noted in the first set of photographs that we know all too well. Thank you.
So I prepared a statement just because I'm less comfortable public speaking than these guys are. In 2005, emanating from a feeling of I can't take it anymore with the Bush administration and a desire to get involved, I started this project. I was introduced to Susan Burke by my friend Donovan Webster. Don had written one of the earliest articles on detainee abuse. It appeared in Vanity Fair in February 2005. After speaking with Don and doing some research, the subject matter grabbed a hold of me. It was a year before I did my first portrait in Amman, Jordan in March of 2006. And my second trip was to Istanbul in the summer of 2007. This is a self-supported project, and initially the only planned use of the photographs was to give Susan 8x10s that she could stick in her files. It became clear to me early on that torture was a subject that people did not want to deal with, talk about, or think about. And I believe, especially in 2005, 2006, a majority of Americans thought that the use of torture was acceptable in certain situations. But torture became an issue because of the discovery and release of the photographs. These photographs had the unintended dual purpose of being used as torture instruments and as well as the sources of evidence for the crimes. So my challenge was twofold. To find a way of drawing people into the torture issue through the use of my camera, which to the detainees had been an instrument of their abuse. And most importantly, I wanted to try to restore the dignity to these people. I wanted the process to be a humanizing one and the final product to be visually as far from the digital point-and-shoot photos as I could make them. This is where my experience as a commercial photographer came into play. I am trying to sell an idea and grab hold of an audience and engage them. I am inviting the viewer into the detainee's world with a pleasing, attractive portrait. Then I am juxtaposing the text, which are all horror stories, and creating a tension that will hopefully, at the very least, make people think. It is important for people to realize that none of the Iraqis that I photographed were quote-unquote high-value detainees. Not that that should make any difference. And that these stories are not aberrations, but examples of what was the standard procedure for the processing of detainees. They were all Iraqis simply caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. In my statement for the Moving Wall show, I wrote, "These individuals were put through unspeakable ordeals, then released without charges being filed. They all have jobs, friends, and families. They need to be remembered not as the man on the leash or the man on the box, but as people whose dignity and humanity have suffered as a direct result of the policies and directives from the government of the United States."
My perspective is a little bit different in this debate, because I was an interrogator in Iraq, and I led interrogators, which I think is actually more important an experience than even doing interrogations, because I was the one who's actually giving advice to interrogators on what techniques to use and not use and what I would permit and not permit. Everybody in this room right now has everything you need to be a good interrogator, and that is you have a chair, you have a brain, and you have a heart. And those are the requirements for being a good interrogator. We have other unique advantages that are given to us from our culture, a culture that's based on tolerance, that's based on compassion, on cultural understanding, and on intellect. And those are the things that we should be leveraging when we conduct interrogations. We've talked a little bit today about high-value targets or low-value targets, people who are innocent or people who are guilty. But one of the big lessons I took away from Iraq was that how we conduct ourselves in interrogations and in the war is more about who we are and not about who our detainees are, or regardless of what they've done. And so I want to share a story with you of an actual interrogation in Iraq. It was of a man named Abu Ali, and this was the first interrogation that I had conducted in Iraq. And I sat down with Abu Ali, who had been caught blessing suicide bombers, who had just left to take to carry out mission. And he was brought back to the prison. And Abu Ali was a Sunni imam. His job within Al-Qaeda was to recruit, and specifically to recruit suicide bombers, and then to send them out, bless them, and send them out on missions. And I sat down from Abu Ali, and the first thing he said to me was, if I had a knife right now, I'd cut your throat. This was a man who was just absolutely filled with hate for America and for Americans. And I looked at Abu Ali, and I said, why? Why do you hate me so much? And he said, because you Americans came here into Iraq, you toppled Saddam, and then you allowed the Shia militias to run free. You put in a policy of de-ba'athification, which put a lot of us Sunnis out of work. And then when the Shia militias ran free, you didn't offer us any protection. They came to my neighborhood, they assassinated my best friend, and then they put a note on my door that told me to leave or I would be next, and I lost my business, I lost my mosque, and my family had to leave. So I started to see Abu Ali, obviously, as an individual who was motivated by very specific reasons for joining Al-Qaeda. This wasn't somebody who had joined out of ideology. It wasn't somebody who had joined because he hated Western culture or hated America or hated our way of life. This was somebody who joined Al-Qaeda out of need, not out of want. And so I came in the next day and I said to Abu Ali, I said, Abu Ali, I want to issue you a formal apology for me as an American, for the mistakes that we've made here in Iraq and the hell that we've put Sunnis through. And I said, but we can't live in the past. We have to be able to, you and I, find a way to work together, Sunnis and Americans, if one day your son and my son are going to be able to walk down the streets of Iraq hand in hand without fear of violence. And the apology alone brought him to tears. Just to hear an American say that they were sorry for the pain that we had caused Sunnis was enough to move him to cooperate. And that later that day, Abu Ali started to provide us the locations of houses that Al-Qaeda used for conducting suicide bombings, for staging them. And at one of those houses, we caught a group of five men, one of whom led us to Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and probably our biggest catch in this conflict in terms of terrorism. It goes to show that when we leverage the best of our culture, which was compassion in this case, and understanding, cultural understanding, and also understanding somebody as an individual and not a stereotype, that we can be very successful. And the best interrogations are those in which we apply our minds. We don't need water buckets. We don't need towels. We don't need to hang people from their arms. We don't need stress positions. We have all the tools we need. In World War II, our interrogators were highly successful using relationship-building approaches. And so the question that I often ask myself is, why would we torture people if there weren't rules? I mean, I was as happy as anyone and as proud when President Obama signed the ban on torture, but I think we addressed a symptom and not a cause. The symptom is that we're torturing people. The cause, I believe, lies closely to prejudice. Until we go back and do a better job of training our soldiers and educating them on other cultures and people who are different than us, then I think we won't have addressed the root cause of why we torture people. And we have to bridge that gap. The future concerns me about interrogations. We have a presidential task force that's supposed to come back with results. And I'm concerned about what that future is going to look like because of the lack of accountability. Yesterday, in a confirmation hearing for Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, who I worked for in Iraq, and I've publicly stated that unlawful techniques were being used while I was there under his command, that I had to stop. He confirmed that. He said that under his command, forced nudity was being used, the use of dogs were used to intimidate prisoners, and sleep deprivation, all of which I consider to be cruelty, to be abuse, and to be a torture, and to be against American law, to be against Geneva Conventions, to be against military regulations. And yet he will probably be confirmed to be the commander of Afghanistan. A lack of accountability is going to have a real effect on the next generation of military leaders, because we have set a dangerous precedent that following unlawful orders is okay. For as long as I've been in the military, every year we've had to do law of armed conflict training in which we've been taught that it is not okay to follow unlawful orders. And we're given the precedents of World War II, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and several other examples. And now we've set an example that it is okay to follow unlawful orders if there's a military necessity. And so I think we still have a lot of work to do on the issue of torture and to change that and to go back and teach our future young leaders that we need to stand up for American principles in the way that we conduct ourselves in this conflict.
Thank all of you for those very powerful and moving remarks and very helpful. And I'm looking forward to the Q&A. I was asked to give a little bit of context before we started the Q&A. And let me just begin by pointing out, which may not be clear to everyone, that Matthew was not an interrogator at Abu Ghraib. And that there was a big difference between prisoners who were brought to the facility that Matthew was working at. I'm very struck by some interviews that were given by an interrogator who was at Abu Ghraib, Tony Lagarenas, which I really encourage people to read. But one of the things that he said was, you know, he was asked, you know, do you think that any of the people that, you know, did you get good intelligence out of what you did? And he said, these were just farmers. They were just people who were caught up in sweeps. The evidence, most of the time, the evidence that brought someone to Abu Ghraib, and we were told that they were a terrorist, and that they were suspected of planning improvised explosive devices, was that they had a shovel and a cell phone. That was the evidence that they might that brought them to Abu Ghraib. So just first that distinction. Why is all of this critically important? You know, our guests have provided very powerful answers to that. Just to pick up on Matthew's last point. You know, the Obama administration clearly and President Obama has articulated a very different vision of how we should conduct ourselves on these issues. And what the Obama administration does is obviously very, very important, because the Obama administration will determine whether or not what happened here was the wild swing of a pendulum or a new plateau, and whether or not it was an aberration or whether or not it's considered a new necessity. And so while President Obama in his recent national security speech at the National Archives articulated a vision of rule of law and adhering to our values and rejected the notion that there's an inconsistency between our national security and our values, when it came to the details, there was enormous cognitive dissonance. He endorsed the use of military commissions. His administration has withheld releasing photographs. His administration has defended the state secrets privilege. He's, as has been noted, steadfastly rejected the notion that we need to have accountability, really of any kind, not just no criminal prosecutions, but not even a nonpartisan effort to get at the truth of what happened. And I do think it's important to recognize that there still could be a great deal that we don't know. I won't say most shockingly of all, because much of this is troubling, but he defended the notion that the United States government might use preventive detention for prisoners. That is, hold people for an indefinite period of time who've never been charged with any offense and aren't even accused of having committed an offense against the laws of war. As was mentioned, there's a task force meeting right now that will make recommendations on interrogation and rendition. There's a task force that will make recommendations on detention policy. There's a task force on Guantanamo. There's the problem of the detention facilities at Bagram. Will we close Guantanamo but merely shift the problem to a less scrutinized site in Afghanistan? And again, as I said, there's the problem of what we don't know. Until the ICRC reports and some recent revelations, we thought we knew the extent of waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Because Jane Mayer wrote, you know, brilliant journalist who's done so much in this field, wrote an article in which she revealed a debate between people about whether or not he was waterboarded 1, 2, or 5 times. That's what we thought we knew, that the outer limit of how many times he might have been waterboarded was 5 times. And we now know that between him and Abu Zarqawi, it was 187 times. So we have to remember that just because some brilliant people have done written wonderful articles and we've gotten some leaks, we don't know really what happened. Let me just start out by asking Chris one question, and that is, Chris, was there, in the process of engaging in this project, was there some, what did you think that you learned, and especially something that may have surprised you?
I think I was most surprised by how the lack of bitterness I felt from the people that we met, because I sat in on the interviews or some of the interviews of the people that I photographed, and how the people, you know, I mean, you're working through an interpreter in most of the cases, so it's a little hard to figure out, but I felt that people were generally kind of dumbfounded that they had been treated this way by the Americans. They just couldn't believe it, and you know, they felt they were better off under Saddam. At the same time, they were also dumbfounded by the fact that here was a group of Americans trying to right the wrongs and to make it better. And I felt, leaving after the first trip, that these pictures never see the light of day. I've done some good just by showing up and showing these people that there are people who do care.
Perfect. Thank you for that. And Susan, let me ask you one question, then we'll just open it up for the panel. I wonder if you could pick up on Matthew's point about the power of the apology, and talk about the litigation and your clients from the point of view of what they hope to gain from the litigation and why that's important to them.
Well, and I think it's, in a sense, what Chris said has been very striking. I mean, all of us as Americans, you know, we're used to damages, we're used to civil remedies. Money is the stand-in for justice. And we are, obviously, we try not to over-promise in any way. And so when we talk with people, we usually begin each trip by talking to people about the fact that these are difficult litigations and it may all come for naught, and that we really cannot, you know, be certain we'll ever be able to obtain any compensation for all the harms that they've suffered. And to a person, all of the Iraqis have made it a point, when we met with them individually, to tell us that simply by listening to them, they feel that they have received some justice, and that what they view as the goal of the litigation is that Americans know what happened to them. They feel very strongly that if people really knew, they wouldn't accept it. And I think that's true. I mean, one of the things that we've always struggled with is, for better or worse, the photographs and the leaks, our culture has all been very centered on, you know, how can we do this as Americans? Have we done it? Have we not? Should we do it? Should we not? There's been no effort to see it through their eyes. And there's been, you know, these are people that are not hard to find. I mean, there's no reason why. We've had one documentary filmmaker come, Roy Kennedy came and did a film. There's really been a lack of interest in hearing, by Americans, of hearing their experiences right from their own mouths. And I think partly it's because it's so horrific that you can hardly stand it. I mean, we had, you know, a young man who was chained in a position for 6 months and hooded for 6 months. When you meet him and you look in his eyes and you realize what we've done, it's almost overwhelming. So I think that justice is really the telling of their stories. And what keeps us going is thinking one day, you know, jurors, American jurors, will agree with them, yes, this shouldn't have happened to you.
Thank you, Susan.
Well,
I just wanted to tell people that if you have a question that you'd like to ask a member of the panel or the panel collectively, please come to the microphones. And this is being recorded, so we do need you to come to the microphones so that what you ask can be clear on the record. Sure, Alan.
The question about the power of apology. I actually forgot the sentinel part of that story I told in my interaction with that individual. Maybe it's because as physicians we're not always the best at apologizing. But one of the 1,000-pound, 500-pound gorilla in the room when I was there often really was an American sitting across from someone. And perhaps that had to do with the level of detail required in doing these kinds of evaluations. And so sometimes there was, I don't know, I wasn't there for catharsis or for kumbaya, and sometimes there was that, but sometimes it was just the interview ended, and I'm not sure that any bridges were built. But in that episode that I described, and in that encounter, before I went off to sob, and when he pulled me close to him and said, you know, thank you for showing me all Americans are not bad, I whispered in his ear, and I said, And I did this again after. I was, even as I was doing this, saying, is this going to undermine my expert credibility? But I was like, I've already made my mind up about what that is. And I whispered in his ear and I said, I am so sorry for what my country, for what our country did for you. Did to you. See, even there, for you. Did to you. And that accountability, you know, I kind of went like, okay, if this happened, and I need to see if there's evidence based on my clinical expertise, it was someone else. It was, you know, these bad apples or the administration. But we have responsibility. We are the ones who voted this, or maybe not in this room, but in this country, that group into power. And so it behooves us in terms of preventing this from happening, in terms of making sure there is an accurate record, in terms of any sense of accountability to those individuals who this happened to, that there be a full investigation. The notion of bad apples in this isolated sense is insane. And actually, even if we want to just say the notion of a group of bad apples, if you look at and define the Bush administration as such, is also, I think, naive to think, well, this is an isolated thing and won't happen again. It will happen again unless we do something to make sure that it doesn't.
Question?
Hi. Thanks all to all of you. It's been really amazing. Matthew, you had said that torture was a symptom and maybe prejudice was the cause you proposed. I'm wondering if you could comment on what you think the goal would have been to cross that line, to start torturing people. You know, especially the military or the, you know, those who are controlling the military to have made that decision, especially after the revelations of that we know that, you know, World War II wasn't used, that you know, there's been all these laws put in place. And so what, do you have a proposition about why we began doing this at this moment in time, beyond prejudice, like what the goal was? I mean, I have a couple of things. I don't want to make a comment. I just want to ask you, but I have a couple ideas.
Well, we know now that at least in the case of one detainee who was rendered to Egypt, that torture, the goal of it was to link Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I can speak just of my experience. I saw a direct link between the people who consistently wanted to use even just harsh techniques. Let's say there's a technique that's legal that's called fear of harsh. There's also a technique that's legal per the manual called pride and ego down, which I believe both are counterproductive to convincing somebody to cooperate, but that are legal under the Army Field Manual. That the interrogators who routinely used those approaches were the same ones who used very derogatory or racial comments in referring to detainees, used terms like raghead and other derogatory terms. There's a link between the people who were passing around a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the people who routinely wanted to use harsh techniques. I believe that these people were approaching interrogations in a spirit of retaliation or dominance. You know, in Iraq, it would always strike me as completely ridiculous when I would hear people link what we were doing there to 9/11. Because obviously Iraqis had nothing to do with 9/11. I think what these people were doing is they're approaching interrogations as an exercise in retaliation. And a lot of that was based on prejudice, in my opinion. I always say that a good interrogation is cooperation. It's not coercion. If you use coercion, a detainee might tell you the location of a house. If you use cooperation, he'll tell you if the house is booby-trapped. And for an interrogator, that's especially if you're going out on the missions, that's a very important difference. The problem with waterboarding or any other type of torture technique that involves pain or suffering is you're shooting to get the minimum amount of information, because the detainee is only going to tell you just enough to make the pain stop or the suffering stop, and that's very obvious now from the interrogations of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. If you have to do something 183 times, you're getting the bare minimum each time. Our goal as an interrogator should be to get the maximum information, to get everything they know and to get it willingly so that we know that it's accurate and truthful. In the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we squandered probably our best opportunity to find Osama bin Laden. What we got was a bunch of junk that basically Khalid Sheikh Mohammed knew that he could give us and still have al-Qaeda survive and conduct operations. And every detainee knows that. They know that they can give stuff up below them or maybe one future operation and the organization will survive. What they're trying to protect is everything above them. And so 183 waterboards didn't keep our country safe. What it did is it failed to find Osama bin Laden, squandered the opportunity to do so, and also became al-Qaeda's number one recruiting tool, which resulted in the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of American soldiers in Iraq.
Another question?
Yeah, I'm Fred Richin. In terms of the photographs that the Obama administration refuses to release at this point, in particular, the arguments have been made, you know, that there's some sense to it in terms of inflaming and so on and so forth. It's not adding anything new. It's a red herring because it's so systemic that all we get is the prosecution of the people in the pictures. You know, we don't get everybody outside the frame. From the victims, from the detainees' points of view, do you feel that it would be salutary for them to see the pictures, that it's a sign of respect to release the pictures, or do you think that it compounds the damage that's already been done by releasing more and more pictures of torture and abuse?
I think that the answer really varies by person, but as an overall matter, they view it as something that's a necessary step along the way towards full accountability. And so, in general, everybody wants the photographs released. The difficulty is that the photographs are them. I mean, we had one instance. We have approximately 170 photographs, and we bring them over and we show. There's a lot of photographs that haven't kind of caught public attention, but that are important from a evidentiary perspective. And so we bring a binder of all the photographs. And we show everyone the photographs and ask them details about locations and did they witness this and did they witness that. We were speaking with one man who's very badly tortured, but very, very, when he was talking about it, he was very calm, did not break down, just recounted what had happened to him. But as we were flipping through the book, there was a photograph of an elderly, somewhat chubby man who had red underwear on his face. And he saw the photograph, and he burst into tears. He said, "I know that's my brother. He's missing two fingers." And so it was devastating to him to see a photograph of his older brother humiliated like that. So on a very personal level, the new photographs will inflict new pain. But given how much these people have gone through, They want to persevere. They want the photographs to help bring the culprits to justice.
Okay. I comment on that from a practical perspective of trying to stop terrorist attacks. You know, the argument that's made is that not releasing them is going to stop retaliatory attacks against us and save our troops from harm that might come out of that. But that's a short-term solution to a long-term problem. As the story I just told you about interrogations and that I found time and time again is when we're willing to make sincere apologies that are backed up by actions, members of Al-Qaeda are willing to, many of them, will abandon that extremist organization and come back and work with us. But the apology has to be sincere. And I certainly, as somebody who's been on the front lines in four wars, understand the risk to troops of releasing those photographs and don't want to see harm come to our troops. But the long-term effect of not releasing that is that we will be consistently criticized by Al-Qaeda for being hypocrites. Mm-hmm. And that will be a stronger recruiting tool for future fighters. And the results of that will be far greater than the short-term effect of releasing the photographs. Mm-hmm. And we have to show that we walk the talk and that we are not a nation of hypocrites, we're a nation of principles, mm-hmm. and that we live up to them.
One thing I'd like to add with regards to the photographs, I mean, I start from a place of disclosure, but then I say, well, okay, let's think about the bigger picture, and willing on that to give our president the benefit of the doubt. But what happens then when it becomes, as we say in medical ethics, the slippery slope of other things withheld, of no accountability, it really does get disconcerting. And so... And again, you know, one of the things with the photographs, too, I think many were struck by this, was the normalcy, the photographs, the initial photographs of Abu Ghraib, was the normalcy of these individuals. They looked like, you know, somebody who could be next door, which speaks to the how this could happen, which was moral disengagement. You vilify the individuals. You maybe contextualize what you're doing as needed and the norm. And what an apology does is it's an effort to rehumanize. And that's a crucial one, because at the end of the day, with all of the BS rhetoric that was out there early, one of the things that wasn't was that term of winning the hearts and minds. And at its essence, that's what you know, an apology in a sense is about really reestablishing or stopping their moral disengagement or dehumanization of us. So it works both ways.
But you're arguing that the Obama administration would release it in the context of an apology, these pictures, which is not what happened with Abu Ghraib pictures.
No, I'm actually, it's not so much the apology, the bigger thing to me, although accountability mm-hmm. is, I think, is a big part of that apology, that perhaps if they said, look, nothing new here, and this is what we're doing, then, or I'm not going to release this publicly, but I have a blue ribbon panel that is going to go through this and everything else, and then we'll come to a fair, you know, and a full reporting. That, I think, would be, you know, appropriate. Mm-hmm. Okay. But this way, it does feel like this isn't going away, and, yeah, again, naive to think that, you know, this is behind us. This is in our face and in front of us.
I was going to ask a question because it seems there's two major dimensions that seem to be at play here, kind of with everyone on the panel in different perspectives, and I wanted to kind of probe which was more dominant for each of you or whoever wants to answer, one of which is the idea of a moral ethical problem, right? Just that morally, ethically, you cannot torture, period, end of story, right? And we can make that determination on our own. We have all the facts that one would need to make that sort of decision, right? And then another one, which I've heard a lot from each of you in a way, is more consequentialist and empirical, right? So in the context of Matthew, right, this idea that torture doesn't work, right? So in one sense, I'm curious, if you were to tweak, I mean, this sort of information is more speculative, right? I mean, there's evidence out there, but it's more speculative. We can't know for sure, in a way, whether or not it is or does work or doesn't work, you know, with certainty. And I'm curious to what extent, if you tweak that, it changes some of your policy preferences or your approach to whatever you're doing, right? So, Matthew, if you thought that torture did work in a particular circumstance, you talked about how we squandered the chance to get Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, right? If you thought that, or Osama bin Laden through Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if you thought that it would work with him, would it be okay to do it then? And Chris, if you found out that one of the people in front of you you're doing a portrait of was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, right, and you didn't know that, how would that shape how you would approach that question? I mean, that guy has the worst war on terror portrait out there, right? I mean, the white T-shirt with the hair and all that sort of thing. I mean, he really needs a new one. So, I mean, and, you know, Susan, I mean, even in your context, I mean, I being a lawyer myself, I know that it's kind of going to be more sort of nuanced, perhaps, in that sense. But I think it could be affecting everyone. I just wanted to see what you guys had to say about that.
If you thought it worked, would that change your perspective?
Well, let me say this. I mean, torture can work on some people. Every technique can work. I can walk into the interrogation booth and hand somebody a cup of water every day, and that might work on a certain percentage of the population. So I think the moral argument, I mean, torture is, the problem with it is not that, well, the way I approach it is this: what technique do I want to use that's most likely to work and quickest as an interrogator on the pragmatic side? And it's not torture. You know, I went out with an Army raid team and conducted missions and did interrogations at the point of capture, where it was like the true ticking time bomb scenario, where we'd have 5 or 10 minutes to get information. What I found worked was using intellect, a lot of street cop techniques, ruses sometimes, and other types of things that have nothing to do with torture or abuse. And so those things work faster. So that's a pragmatic argument. But I think the moral argument is so much more important, because then it's not just interrogation we're talking about. We're talking about our morals as they apply to everything we do and every aspect in how we fight this war.
And I think from my vantage point, the way I think of it is that it's illegal. And what offends me most about the debate is that we've essentially let people unilaterally rewrite the law, and that is not how the laws are passed in this country. So I think you cannot just vest power in the hands of the troops over there to decide effectiveness. You have got to train people to abide by the laws. And so the total destruction of the rule of law cannot benefit our democracy. It's got to play into others' extremist hands. So I find that the legal framework is, for me, the most important thing.
Yeah, and I come down on the side of torture is wrong. And there were definitely, I mean, my gut feeling, I think, was a couple people I photographed, was it was like a little unsettling. And, you know, at the time, especially on my first trip, it was early and the air everywhere was a little heavier, you know, and that felt like I was, you know, had to be more secret about it and everything. And I think bad guys should be locked up. But at the same time, I don't believe that, you know, it's like going fishing with a shotgun or something. You know, you just like go yank people off the street and torture everyone, and hopefully someone will come up with some kind of okay answer. You know, I think it was completely wrong across the board, and even in the sort of ticking time bomb scenario that they love to bring up, it makes no sense to me.
Would it make a difference in your photographic practice? So, I mean, if it's about restoring dignity in a way, right?
Right. Well, no, I mean, I went into it, you know, I would definitely went into it not as a documentarian, but as a trying to convey a message. And so there was no objectivity on my part. You know, I definitely went in feeling that these people were wrong, this practice was wrong, and I was doing everything I could in my powers as a photographer to convey that message. So there was no, it was not unbiased at all. You know, it was like writing an editorial.
I want to comment on both aspects of what you bring out. First of all, in science and in research, there's a saying, garbage in, garbage out. These methods may get people to talk, but it's dubious. And in fact, we do know a lot about their ineffectiveness. One, from the information we did not get, and from other information we did get from these methods, some of which led us into this war to begin with, which were found to be wholly unsubstantiated. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, this whole, what one thing I've been struck by is just the utter assault on the English language, and that I said words have meaning, and that the debate hasn't even happened. The Bush administration wanted it to be, we didn't torture, we used enhanced interrogation, you know, new and improved. And that if you're going to have the debate, at least call it what it is. I mean, from a moral, from a legal, from a scientific, from whatever perspective, you know, this was torture. And if you want to have the debate about, well, should we be doing this, that's where it's been. But it shouldn't be. It was like it was wanted both ways. And in fact, the hubris that I think we've seen over the last few weeks from Mr. Cheney and a whole host of others, actually, I found myself at first with President Obama saying, well, you know, maybe we do need to move on. But that hubris really reminded me of that. This is not going away. This is maybe under this administration we'll take a break. But, you know, one executive order away from this happening. The moral perspective, you know, in addition to is it effective in that specific episode of getting information, you know, I think unlikely on scientific grounds, but even if it were, you need to look at a greater societal impact, an epidemiological impact in terms of that what we have done by doing this, we have made the world a much more dangerous place for the Tibetan monk who is arrested for torture and tortured for chanting long live the Dalai Lama, for the African student activist. And in fact, one thing we've taught folks like Mr. Mugabe in Zimbabwe and others is, you know, use the T word, the terrorist, and that's a very effective way. And in fact, also, if you look at where these methods came from, those methods that we use came from ultimately a manual, I believe by the Chinese, that was all about getting false confessions. It was never about the truth.
You know, I've read every single word of the debate on the Military Commissions Act, and not one member of Congress made the argument that torture works and it's okay and we ought to use it. I mean, it, just to pick up Alan's point, and even as the Republican-controlled Congress, backed by the Bush administration, rewrote the laws to try and make not felonies what they did, they still wrote a statute that makes it a felony to cause serious mental and physical suffering which need not be prolonged. That's a felony in the United States as the Republicans rewrote the law, causing serious mental and physical suffering which need not be prolonged. And, you know, it's a crime. It's a crime as the last administration rewrote the law. You had a question.
My question is actually, there's been a lot of talk lately, a lot of articles about whether or not people who have been interrogated, whether or not they're going to, even if they were completely innocent or hadn't really done anything, and like some of you mentioned earlier, they were just kind of picked up off the street basically and then tortured and then released after a while. If some of them actually, even though they were innocent to begin with, having been treated that way, if they in turn will now become, you know, what we originally thought they might be, like terrorists or people who might try to do harm to others. And I'm just kind of curious as to your different perspectives on that, particularly, I guess, yours in the military aspect, Mr. Alexander, kind of whether or not you think that this is something that really does happen or will happen in the years to come, as these people kind of come to terms with what's been done to them, and as our current administration battles with whether or not to actually acknowledge, you know, and kind of fully disclose the details of it.
I think within the military, we know certainly that if we detain somebody who's not guilty of a crime or not involved in insurgency and we use torture or abuse, that they certainly will have a greater tendency to join after they get out. And in fact, post Abu Ghraib, after the photos were revealed, it was pretty common knowledge that Abu Ghraib itself became a recruiting ground for al-Qaeda because of the people who had been tortured and the knowledge there of what had happened. I know my experience, let me say this to start off with, counterinsurgency is tough. It's extremely difficult when you're fighting an enemy or trying to detain people who don't wear uniforms, who blend in with the population. And so it is a difficult task. I don't ever want to underplay that. This is an extremely difficult task. And trying to develop intelligence that's valid and reliable and accurate is extremely difficult. Aside from the arguments of whether or not we should be in certain places. But I went out and we conducted raids based on information, and sometimes that information didn't come anywhere close to what we would call probable cause. And it wouldn't have anyway satisfied the same standards that I had to use when I was a criminal investigator to get a search warrant. And we detained people sometimes based on evidence, for instance, propaganda, that would have never satisfied the threshold for detaining people here in the United States. That would have fallen under your First Amendment rights. And so what we're asking the military to do in Iraq when we're going out and doing missions to detain people is police work. And soldiers are not trained traditionally to do police work, and that has made the task very difficult. That said, what I found is when we did go into the wrong house and we figured that out, again, the power of an apology and compensation would go miles towards ensuring that that person didn't join the insurgency after we left because we were there. What I also found out to my disappointment is that that's not what was happening before I arrived, and that going into the wrong houses, they would just leave. And so that's the type of thing that's not going to win hearts and minds, and that's why we have to ensure that we do the right things when we do detain the wrong people.
I think on that point, it's interesting to hear the stories, and the reason that I'm somewhat optimistic that even when people have been very, very poorly treated, they may not all turn to violence, is because many had very mixed experiences. They would be terribly tortured, and then they would meet somebody like Matthew, who apologized to them, who said, "We shouldn't have done this." And many of them had these mixture of experiences, so it wasn't a monolithic view of America. We do know simply from, I mean, obviously the folks we talk to are the self-selected group who have not turned to violence. And one man in particular, Haj Ali, he started his own human rights organization, really reaching out to other victims to try to make sure they don't turn to violence. And I think that that it is having, I mean, I do think that a lot of them have not, I mean, they are living in amidst all the violence. So I think many of them are choosing not to turn to violence. Certainly, you know, you think about how many have come to us for a nonviolent resolution of what happened to them.
We know from the medical literature that if someone is abused as a child, if someone witnesses their father beat their mother, they are more likely to be an abuser themselves. That's very, very clear. Now, I balance that with my experience of having cared for many torture survivors, and I'm amazed at, you know, the level of forgiveness and humanity. Although with post-traumatic stress, a diagnosis that often gets made, and too commonly perhaps, but a sine qua non of that is irritability and short-temperedness. And so again, the way to address that, and I think the thing in our program and the thing through apologies, is again putting it back in the human context and in a sense defusing that anger, that hatred, recontextualizing it. And so that's ultimately how you prevent, so we shouldn't be doing this, and then how you address. Because, you know, you can't say, well, we tortured this individual, and yes, we may well have created some terrorists who weren't before. But what are you going to do then? Well, we screwed up. We need to keep them more. It's the only way out that I see it is a genuine accountability and backing it up with real, you know, actions to show we mean that.
For the soldiers themselves as well. I mean, that's the other kind of piece of it when you think about the victims and the violence. I mean, many of the men and women that have participated in the torture, you know, there's been suicides, there's been repeated violence. I mean, it gets at them as well.
The Bush administration was quite brilliant about its use of language and the way it framed debates and getting people to use its terminology. And one thing that it really did quite successfully, and everybody's bought into it, and we all talk about it the same way, and that is how many people released from Guantanamo have returned to the fight. return to the fight? Well, doesn't that sort of assume that they were in the fight to begin with as opposed to innocent and they were just caught up? And how many people do we think that the Bush administration determined had actually been in the fight, done something wrong, and they released them? I mean, almost by definition, most of the people that the Bush administration released, they determined were there by mistake. So these people that the Pentagon is saying, you know, and we've kind of bought into this, it's 11%, it's 9%, you know, how many returned to the fight? Almost all these people probably weren't doing anything before they were brought to Guantanamo.
So there's an unforeseen scientific study that if you torture people, the prevalence of individuals, the risk of becoming a terrorist if you weren't before, maybe perhaps is at least 1 in 10.
Great panel, by the way. I'm curious about what you think you might happen if the work all of you do is not successful. I'm curious about, Dr. Keller briefly referred to how the work that's being done would affect these different scenarios and things. If the apologies are not made, if the lawsuits don't work, if there are no more photographs taken, if there's not the treatment is not done, and maybe if you could maybe imagine specifically, what would be the, what keeps you up at night? What keeps you up at night and say, if I don't go into work in the next morning and do this, this is what I think is going to happen?
Well, from my perspective, the way I think of it is that the victims get handed a loss at trial, that they have an American jury that says, yeah, you know, this may have happened to you, but all things considered, we don't care. And I think that that a failure of that sort would lead me to pursue it in international tribunals. I mean, I very much believe in the American judicial system. I believe in the balance of powers. And I have a lot of hope and confidence that that branch of our government will help us remain the United States. But these are crimes that need to be redressed. We cannot simply we're Americans. It doesn't mean we can write the law of the globe. So to me, failure just means this will turn from not, you know, kind of a 10-year endeavor, but until, you know, like right until I'm dead endeavor. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen.
You know, success is an outcome. So the question is how do you define success? It could be that, okay, we've gotten X individuals disbarred. We've gotten X number of doctors who've lost their medical licenses. We, you know, have individuals who've been prosecuted. That is one way. And I think, though, there are more subtle outcomes. One that I think regardless is that there will be more information disclosed and that there will, one way or another, be more accountability. And if one consistent thing in this whole episode has been that there's never been information we've found that has said, well, we didn't do, we're overstating what we did. Everything that speaks to that, whatever we know is perhaps the tip of the iceberg. So I think actually that disclosure of additional information, which will happen, if not today, hopefully in the future, is one, is crucial. So what keeps me up at night, I guess one, is that I think it's counterproductive. I believe we are putting kerosene on a fire. I believe we have put the Tibetan monk, the activist in Zimbabwe, our own soldiers in harm's way, unnecessarily. And then also, you know, my children, you know, that what kind of world are we, raising them in, you know, a world that allows these things, and that in an incredibly, impressively naive and simplistic Jack Bauer-esque way, actually perhaps thinks it even works.
I think there's already been some success just in the fact that we've been trying to raise awareness of the issue. And I also I'm not as intimately involved as these folks are, but I kind of think the momentum has got this ball moving and it's not going to stop. Maybe it won't go to where everybody wants it to, but I think there's enough momentum with this issue that it's going to keep going. So I And I also think that, in the way that the torture has become a recruiting tool, and that you affect the whole family and the friends, people trying to help is doing the same. And so one person who was tortured, then there's all of a sudden a group of people trying to help that person. That is also spreading that sort of goodwill throughout. So I think it's starting to push back a little bit. Matthew?
What keeps me up at night, I'm going to put on the hat of Al-Qaeda for a minute and take their point of view on this. One of Al-Qaeda's stated goals is to prove that we're a nation of hypocrites, that we say one thing and do another, and that we don't live up to the principles that we say we do. This is a strategic, and I'm using the word strategic, not tactical or operational. This is a strategic victory for them when we don't hold people accountable, because it helps, it allows them to achieve one of their major goals in this war, in this conflict. And what that does is it helps them to build their ranks by recruiting fighters, but also by recruiting the passive support of other people in the Middle East who normally would reject Al-Qaeda's extremist view. So what keeps me up is that this is extremely counterproductive to battling against extremist ideologies, and that's on, that goes for both sides of the war, and that's what I worry about.
For what it's worth, I worry that we're still arguing about these things and we haven't got the story out and got a national consensus about what how counterproductive this was with people like Sandra Day O'Connor and others involved in it, so it's really seen as nonpartisan, and we have another attack.
Well, excuse me, that's one thing that does bother me, that people really don't understand what happened. And I think people still seem to think that it was a small group of people doing it to a small group of Iraqis, and that it was not sort of a widespread corporate policy, and that this was how it happened.
Animal House on the night shift.
You said that language is being manipulated to define this argument, and you know, former Vice President Dick Cheney has repeatedly said, you know, like when the next attack comes, he's making the assumption that this argument started on September 12th. The first attack happened on his watch, and so if and when the next attack comes, it's not like they kept us safe and now another attack has happened. They failed to keep us safe because of intelligence failures that happened on their watch. And so that's another way I think that the language has been manipulated. I think from my perspective, someone who's done anti-terrorism in about 15 countries, I know we'll have another attack. I mean, we had Beirut bombing, we had Cobra Towers, we had USS Cole from somebody in the military. 9/11 wasn't the first terrorist attack. We've been battling terrorism for quite a number of years, and we will have another attack. And it'll be interesting to me to go back and trace the roots of that and find out where those recruits came from and why they joined Al-Qaeda.
One of the things that makes this current moment so scary is if you think about the reaction that the world had when the American people re-elected George Bush. You know, I mean, it was one thing when people said, you know, he stole the election, you know, it was a, blah, 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 it was a mistake. And then after all of this, after the invasions, then the American people reelected George Bush. And you know, I heard from a lot of colleagues in OSI that people came to them and, you know, it was like, well, we just thought this was a mistake and it was an aberration. You reelected this guy. Now we've elected Barack Obama. And if he validates this stuff, his administration validates this stuff, that keeps me up at night.
And yeah, along that lines, the accountability, I mean, it begins with our country. How did we sign a pact with an administration that basically said, you get to live your lives like you think you did before, and just let us do what we need to do? So that's one. And then I'd like to think we do give ourselves credit, and it was simply because the economy is in the toilet that we elected President Obama. But that, yeah, again, if that turns out to be a hollow follow-through, that I think potentially could have even greater harm because the expectations have been ratcheted up.
I wanted to bring the conversation back to photography, and my question is actually for Susan. You made the unusual decision to involve Chris in your efforts as well as other artists. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about some of the other projects that came out of this as well as Chris's and why you made that decision and what you see the impact being of involving artists in the work.
Well, and I do want to recognize Nick Flynn, who's right here, is an author, and he has come with us as well on the trips. It actually, I think, was, I was influenced by Amnesty. I've worked with Amnesty for years, and their imagery of the victims has always been so powerful that I've thought that in a way the arts are a wonderful way to communicate. And when I went on the first trip and met these people, I was so struck by their beauty and their power that I thought, well, you know, in some ways, I mean, I do civil litigation. I'm a trial lawyer. It takes years. You know, I knew we were not going to be getting to a jury anytime soon. And I thought that I need to start making sure that already people understand who these people are and that they don't wait years and years to learn who they are at a trial. And it was not without controversy. I mean, lawyers tend to operate, you know, behind closed doors with their own clients, and we actually lost one member of the legal team who thought I was a real idiot for doing it. But, you know, it's been fascinating. I think that the victims have benefited by, you know, the beauty of Chris's work. Daniel Heyman, an artist who's done beautiful work, and you can see he's had various shows in New York and elsewhere. Rory Kennedy came with us and made the film. So it's been a from my vantage point, besides the fact that I've gotten to, you know, meet and become dear friends with these wonderful people, it's been a success in terms of some minor benefit that we can give the victims immediately.
We're almost at the end of this fabulous discussion, and why don't I just ask the panelists if they have any closing words that they'd like to offer.
I think that so much needs to be done, and everyone needs to help spread the message that what we are seeing cannot remain as it is. I mean, Alan has talked about it being the tip of the iceberg. We've had some access to information that's not public, and what is public is the tip. This is a sequence of criminal behavior, and this is our country. Everybody has a duty to make sure that we don't let this go unaccounted for.
I'd like to bring it back to the photographs. So, you know, again, as a physician and as a scientist, you start with the epidemiological perspective. Okay, how many tens of thousands, whatever, of individuals? And it's kind of hard to get your hands around that. Then you get down to the clinical evaluations of 10 of 12 individuals that I did, and actually of another that even before that PHR study, somebody I evaluated for a 60-minute show that never aired. So there, I think, an example of lack of accountability in the media as well, because it decided, well, that story's already been told. So those stories and the narratives and the information give a piece of what happened. But there's still a distance. Then you get to the photographs from the original photographs from Abu Ghraib, which really do give you a sense of the utter horror of what happened, the utter normalcy of what happened, that these individuals smiling in front of naked pyramids, and that these were, it's easier for those photos make it clearer than I'd ever thought that it's easier for these things to happen than we'd like to think. And then you get to the powerful photographs out there, the rehumanization, the reconnection with the individual, the eyes as a window, as was said, to the torture that happened, but also as, or those photographs, I was saying, the eyes in those photographs as a window to the soul, of showing the sadness, but of also showing, you know, the exceptional resilience. And I think we need to keep that in mind. And with that narrative thread, we need to take this through to its logical conclusion of disclosure, of accountability, and of apology.
Yeah, I think what motivated me to do it is because I feel like there was really specific, it wasn't an accident that this happened. There were really specific decisions made for this to happen by a select group of people. And the ripple effect has been enormous. And it just eats away at our moral fiber. And people aren't quite getting it. And that's what motivates me, is that how it seeps in to everything we do. I mean, it seeped into television shows. It seeped in, you know, there's jokes about torture in commercials now. I mean, it's really found its way into a lot of our society. And that is what kind of I want to try to remind people, that this happened to real people and it's wrong. Matthew?
I want to end on a positive note, which is to say one of the amazing things to me is that former soldiers and people from the military rarely come together and work with journalists, with artists, with physicians, with lawyers, and with human rights organizations. And this has been one of the most incredible things to me, is how all these people came together, people from very varied backgrounds, to oppose torture and to oppose abuse of prisoners. And we did that because we have this commonality of humanity. And so I used to tell people on active duty, if you haven't guessed, people in the military often have a negative view of human rights organizations or nonprofits. And I used to tell them, why would your duties as a soldier ever be in contrast to your duties as a human? So this has been actually a great opportunity to come together and to work on a common issue.
Well, thank you for that. I want to remind people that Chris's photographs are right outside. If you haven't seen them, please do. And even if you have seen them, you might want to take a look at them again after having heard the panel. And with that, it's simply my privilege to thank the panel for their comments. To much more importantly, thank you for your work, and to invite our audience to thank you for a very rich discussion.